Thank you. Thank you. hour ago?
Yes, Roxanne.
We haven't seen each other in a very long time. That's right, with honor. Thank you. Martha McGee.
Hi, Martha. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, very nice to meet you.
No.
Okay.
No. There's so many sisters. You might want to.
Maybe.
You're not going to talk for a few minutes, but if you want to take them off and use them, handheld and them.
Oh, that's very funny. I didn't want to.
No, I'm just passing over the way to you. We were talking a while ago.
Well, good evening, everyone. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian. Welcome to the Society Library, and thank you for coming out and joining a full house tonight. It's my pleasure to welcome our introducer for this evening's program, Adrian Ingram. Adrian has joined our Board of Trustees this year and is one of 23 people who keep me busy and keep me in order. So please welcome Adrian Ingram.
Welcome, everyone, and I will be in front of you for only a few seconds because I read this book when it came up on NetGalley, and it was one of the best books that I have read in many, many years. I laughed, I cried, and it did what good books are supposed to do. It made me think about my own life in a much deeper way. And I am so honored. I had no idea that the Society Library was going to do a program on it. I just loved the book and read it. So I'm delighted to introduce Elizabeth Benedict. She is the author of 5 novels, and including a National Book Award finalist. And she has written for many publications, including the New York Times, LA Times, Esquire. And she's the editor of another book, which I'm currently reading, called Mentors, Muses, and Monsters, which is also excellent. I'm not sure which one I like best. But she really focused on the issue of what's the most meaningful gift that your mother ever gave you. And that's what tonight's panel is on. You are in for a treat.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you to everyone for coming out. Thank you to Sarah Holliday at the library. Thank you to the library. thank you to various members of my family, including my sister, who's here, to whom she's one of the people the book is dedicated to my husband, who sat in on about seven of these so far, and to my high school art teacher, who's also here. So this is a very important event for me, personally. I gave a talk on Sunday and to a senior group of students who were in an adult ed center, and the woman doing the talk said, "This is not going to be saccharine sweet, is it?" Because I've heard from a number of people that they don't want it to be saccharine sweet, and I said, "Don't worry. That's the last thing you have to worry about." And a number of the reviews, actually quite a lot of the reviews, say, "This book really made me nervous to pick up because I really thought it was going to be incredibly sentimental, and I'm happy to say that it's not." And it's a useful way to talk about the difference between, and there's my cousin Carol. I'm sorry, I didn't even see you. I was so fixed on my sister, I couldn't even, you know, my cousin Carol. There's a difference between emotion and sentimentality, and this book is full of deep emotion, and because of that, it's not sentimental. And the other thing that I wanted to say at the beginning, that there are two kinds of mothers in this book, or at least two, but the two biggest divides for me are the happy mothers and the unhappy mothers. And some people have said to me, I can't come to your event because I had a terrible relationship with my mother, and I don't want to read about all these happy relationships. And I assure them that that's not going to be a problem. And there are not, and so I spent a lot of time in some of these events talking about the sort of happy mothers versus unhappy mothers, and I just want to point out, we're not talking about good mothers versus bad mothers. We're talking about, or I'm talking about, mothers who had a hard time, mothers who had hard lives, therefore children had hard lives, or families in which a mother died young and the children had a very hard time. And then very fortunate families where mothers lived and thrived and you know, had in the continuum a happier experience. And so that's the kind of range in the book. I don't want anyone to be nervous that her difficult relationship with her mother will not be represented here. I want to begin with just telling you how this book came to be. This book came to be because of this scarf, which my mother gave me when she lived at the Esplanade in White Plains. It's an assisted living facility. And it was the last gift she ever gave me. And I began to wear it on my winter coat. And almost every time I wore it, somebody said, "What a beautiful scarf." And you can see why. It's very dramatic. And then they'd say, "Where did you get it?" And I would sort of swallow and sort of say, "My mother gave it to me. She was in assisted living." And it wasn't a happy story for me, and I really wanted to just be able to say Bloomingdale's, but I couldn't. And over the years, my mother died several years after she gave it to me, and of course I wore it every single day of every winter, and I became obsessed with it, and because I was physically close to it, literally it was around my neck, but it was also, more than that, it was around my face when it got cold, and I would just wrap it in circles around my face. And I was very kind of perplexed, and I kept thinking, you know, I had such a distant relationship with my mother in life, but this scarf was this sort of physical embodiment of my mother, and she was keeping me warm. And I was very kind of baffled by all of these feelings, and never spoke to anyone, and I literally did not have the words to talk about whatever this feeling was that I had, or this group of feelings. And one day I said to myself, as writers sometimes do, "I wonder if other women have a gift from their mothers like this that encapsulates the relationship, that opens the door to the relationship." And I started inviting people, and here we are. And of course, when you start doing this, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know if other people will sign on. You don't know if you'll get a book contract. You don't know if your publisher will do a good job with the book. You don't know if your book will come out the week before September 11th, which happened to one of my novels. You don't know, you know, any. There are just a whole lot of unknowns when you put a book together. And this book seems to have touched a nerve with a lot of people. And so now that you know how I started the book, I want to ask each of the writers about what it was like when you got the email from me. Did you, and I don't think I knew Margot. I didn't know Martha, I'm sorry. This is Roxana Robinson right here. This is Martha McPhee. This is Margot Jefferson. They are, I'm so sorry. It's just all about me, you know. They're all extremely distinguished, prolific writers of many genres and many subjects, and their biographies are in the materials that you have. But Roxana has written biographies and novels. Martha has written novels. Margot has written a lot of journalism. She was the theater critic for the New York Times for many years. And I knew that they would do a good job if I asked them. But what was it like for each of you when you got this email from me, in a stranger, asking you this sort of personal question? Did you want to do it right away? Did you just know what you wanted to write about right away? Did you balk? Did you say, not sure? And, you know, just talk about sort of the emotional approach to doing this and ending up here, if you would. And take a microphone, or Roxana.
It's not going to be worth it once I don't have that much to say. I was glad to get the email. My mother was failing at that point. My mother died last October at the age of 101. And so it was not unexpected. She had been sort of slowly fading away. And I had written a number of pieces about her, but what my mother gave me was a horse. And when I told Liz that, she said, good, that no one else has, we don't have any other horses in the collection. But I wanted to write about this passage in my childhood. I was a horse crazy young girl, and it was a complete obsession with me. I thought of horses all the time. I pretended I was a horse. I kind of was a horse. And I would look at a deep green meadow, and I would almost salivate. I just was really into it. So horses, and my mother was somebody who thought that children should get a chance to realize their deepest wish, which she called a heart's desire. And so we were each given a heart's desire, and my heart's desire was a horse. And I was given one. I was allowed to get one. I paid for half of her myself when I was 12, and no one else in the family rode, and no one else knew how to take care of horses. So it was a huge leap of trust for my parents to do this for me. And in fact, we were moving to a new house anyway, and we got a house with a barn and a little back paddock so that I could have a horse. I had wanted to write about this. So it was when I got the email from Liz, I thought, okay, go.
When you wrote to me, I knew immediately that I would like to do the essay. I love writing essays. I'm a novelist, and I don't do it that much. So the idea of writing about my mother for an anthology was wonderful. And I knew immediately what it would be what my topic would be, because my mother helped me in a very clever way come up with money that I needed as a young woman to buy the lease to a New York City apartment. And it was a lot of money. It was $15,000, and I was a starving graduate student, and she didn't have the money, and my father, even if he did have the money, would never have loaned me money to put in a paper bag to buy a lease to an apartment. And she did. She was very clever. She actually had a man who owed her a favor. She was she is a photographer, and this guy who wore a floor-length fur coat and a diamond pinky ring owed her a favor because he was accused of being a peeping Tom. And she took a photograph that revealed that it was impossible for him to do that. So he couldn't be tried or whatever. And she took him out to lunch and said, "My daughter needs to borrow some money to buy a lease." And he said, "Oh, what?" He didn't think it was a very smart business proposition, but he loaned her the money, and I got the lease, and I still live in the apartment. So I knew right away what I wanted to write about. Thanks.
Trap. Are we all right?
All right. Well, it was welcome and yet a little complicated. I've been working on a book about the world of my parents, this variously termed talented 10th, black bourgeoisie, colored Negro, African American elite. So I'd been collecting all kinds of material, and the book was turning out to have so much to do with women, with being a girl, and with mothers, and with all the, since I was born in 1947, with all the elaborate structure of rituals and conventions and manners, everything from what kinds of handkerchiefs you carry to wearing white socks with Mary Jane's, not other socks, et cetera. And so, all of that was there, and my mother was at the center of it. And I'd also found myself, writing a book in certain ways is like curating. If you're writing about, periods past, times past, it's kind of like curating a museum exhibit. You start collecting all kinds of material. And I was leafing through old Vogues, and which mother had subscribed to, and old Ebony's, which she'd subscribed to, and old pictures. And I realized that clothes and fashion and the language of clothes for a child and of glamour for me in this childhood that was very sheltered, but was also, in the 50s, very circumscribed in certain ways by a society that was still partly integrated, often segregated. And my parents were always making, charting a very canny way through that. Once I had a conversation with my mother that set it in motion, which begins the piece, I was off to go. I was home visiting her, and we were going to a club meeting. And she's 96 now. She always took a long time to dress, but it takes longer now. But it's also because, again, you have to have everything. So I was saying, "Oh, Mother, our ride's here." And she said, "Have you put on cologne?" "No." And when we came home, I was so charmed by what she was wearing and the care she took with it that I just started asking her, "Well, what were your favorite clothes and why?" And then that reminded me of all the glamorous music, the jazz and the Broadway tunes my parents had danced to. Then I was off to the races with curating the museum of my mother in our world.
do you want to read a few pages?
Sure.
Stand up here.
Since I'm here, I will. Yes, all right. I will begin. All right. right. These are a few excerpts, so don't mind slightly leaping transitions. For girls like my sister and me, bourgeois girls of the 1950s and early 60s, shopping was an intricately plotted expedition. I'm from Chicago, so... all right.
Don't touch it.
Yes. Something girls... Our mother was the leader and guide. She showed us what to look for as our eyes wandered and wondered. She showed us what to pass by. She directed the gaze. Marshall Field, where mother took us to sit on Santa's knee at Christmas in a maze of giant wreaths, candy canes, and glazed whirling ornaments. Marshall Field, where mother took us to lunch at the Walnut Room. Marshall Field's 28 shop, where mother told her mother, "You really shouldn't smoke here." And her mother answered, "As much as I pay for these clothes, I'll do what I want." Marshall Field, where my father's Aunt Nancy passed for white to work as a saleswoman in the 1920s. I worshipped the offerings of feminine glamour in magazines, movies, and in life. The clothes, the lingerie, the array of handkerchiefs, some lace-trimmed, some initialed, pocketbooks of leather and alligator bearing their own mirrors and coin purses, pot-au-soir clutch bags for evening, or small beaded ones with handles that slipped just over your wrist. The perfume and cologne bottles on mother's vanity table and the dresses, the earrings, bracelets, necklaces arranged in the jewelry box with its Florentine design. I learned to accept the verbotens, too. One summer day, I came downstairs wearing a red blouse and a purple and white floral skirt. I was sent right back upstairs to change. You don't wear certain colors together, especially loud colors. Denim is only for weekend play and summer camp. Little girls don't wear nail polish. Little girls wear white socks with their Mary Janes. I accepted the verbotens because I longed to be a perfect girl, and if a girl lacked perfect prettiness, which I did, then this was a route to compensatory perfection. I accepted the verbotens because they came from my mother, whose appearance and manner I found both authoritative and deeply pleasing. Her crisp Claudette Colbert hairdo, her 5'3" frame, trim and shapely but not skinny, her smooth beige-brown skin. She was witty, lively, and chic. So were her friends. I loved how they looked in their suits and silk shirtwaists, their furs and smart hats. I loved how they carried themselves at luncheons and parties or when they took us to plays or concerts. I loved the quick comments and judgments they flung out. They were in full command. And then I will just read the ending. I often look through the clothes my mother has seen fit to give me through the years. I never cease to regret the ones she gave away or gave to my sister. I cherish the Pauline Trigere brushed wool funnel-shaped coat, beige with thin stripes of pale mauve, lilac, blue, and white. Such quiet symmetry it could be wallpaper. I feel like a craft object when I close my body into this coat. And I feel vindicated, too, because Pauline Trigere was the first top American designer to use a black model regularly. We always knew these things. Jet, ebony, or our mothers told us. Bravo, Madame Trigere. Still, the piece I most love wearing is Mother's gold brocade cocktail dress with matching jacket. It was designed by Malcolm Starr, best known for bejeweled 60s evening wear. The dress is sleeveless with wide straps, a nipped waist, and a wraparound style skirt. Not a wide skirt, but wide enough for a feminist to walk in without mincing her steps. The waist-length jacket is trimmed in gold braid. So is the skirt's front panel. It's flip and flirty, as my mother prescribed. It's crisp, yet splendid. It makes me feel I've put on made-to-order armor. My mother's armor. Armor that helped shield me from exclusion. Armor that shielded me from inferiority.
called The Deal. I was being thrown out of an illegal sublet on Claremont and LaSalle in Harlem. The apartment belonged to Columbia University, and I was renting it from two professors who'd taken jobs elsewhere but hadn't wanted to let go of the low rental in New York City. Columbia had caught on, and I was being evicted. It was 1990. I'd just been accepted to Columbia's MFA program in fiction, but it didn't come with housing. A sister, I have four, referred me to a realtor who had a knack for finding spacious, rent-stabilized apartments. Her name was Jan. The apartments she showed me were decidedly not deals, enormously expensive, tiny, smelling of cat pee and looking onto brick walls. I was 26 years old. I had an entry-level job in publishing that paid $200 a week and consumed most of my waking hours, and a nighttime job as a waitress to earn extra cash, from which I was about to be fired because I was too exhausted to be charming. Even so, I was filled with ambition and dreams of becoming a writer, but still had nowhere to live, and time was running short. "It'll work out," my mother said to me tirelessly over the phone. A blind faith is hers, and an imagination that allows for extreme cleverness. These are her gifts to me. I always believed her. As hard as it can be sometimes, I still do. After seeing another collection of unlivable apartments, Jan looked at me as if an idea were igniting. "I have the apartment for you." My eyes lit up. "But you'll never be able to afford it." My eyes dimmed. "It's huge, sweeping city views, dining room, living room, two beds, three baths, 1,600 square feet, low rent. We were standing on Broadway at 103rd Street, wilted from the last viewing. Car alarms and sirens and horns, a shuffle of people. "Tell me more," I said, and she did. The apartment was leased to an eccentric with long fingers, manicured nails, and wild gray hair, an aspiring pianist with a baby grand in his foyer. He wanted to move to Long Island, but he, like the professors, didn't want to let go of his deal unless he could get something for it. He wanted to sell the lease and was asking $15,000 in cash. "It's called a key fee," Jan explained. "Let me know if you want to see it." She slipped into a cab, disappearing down Broadway. "See it," my mother said when I told her. I'd been doing calculations in my head. The rent was $1,000 a month. The tiny places I'd been viewing were the same price and more. If I rented out the second bedroom and the dining room for $700 apiece, I could live rent-free with income. But how would I come up with the $15,000? "It'll work out," my mother said. "See it." Stop there.
I just want you to both keep on reading. I want to hear you read the whole thing. Okay, I'll do two bits. And the first is describing my passion for horses. I especially loved Arabians with their delicate bones and dished faces and arched necks, their fiery natures and flowing tails. Swift and sure-footed, they galloped across the burning sands under an azure sky. They were romantic heroes, and besides, I was related to them. The Godolphin Barb was a small Arabian stallion given as a present by the Bey of Tunis to the King of France. Somehow the little Barb wound up in England, owned by the Earl of Godolphin, who had a famous racing stud. At that time, the early 18th century, English racehorses were big and heavy-boned. The slight, light-boned Arab, only 15 hands high, was not considered suitable breeding stock. But the Barb was high-spirited and fiery and more forceful than anyone expected. An aristocratic mare at the stud was meant to be bred to a big stallion called Hobgoblin, but the mare refused him decisively. She preferred the Barb, and finally she was allowed to accept his advances. Their first foal, a colt called Lath, won the Queen's Plate 9 times. And so began the Barb's history as one of the greatest racing sires of all time. His offspring were phenomenal runners, and one of his descendants was called Seabiscuit. The name of the mare was Lady Roxana. So I took that as a sign. And this is the horse that my mother allowed me to get. Blakewell Bay was a small red chestnut mare about 15 hands high. She was a purebred American saddle horse. I was proud of her breeding, and I still have her papers somewhere. She was short-legged and straight-necked, not much of a beauty, but she was good-tempered and willing, and I loved her. She became the center of my life. At feeding time, I taught her to pick me up down by the house. She came down from the barn to where I sat on the fence, sidling sideways so I could jump easily aboard, then carried me up to the barn. Inside, she took me to the ladder leading to the hayloft. I climbed up it to pour grain into her bucket and drop hay into the stall. Sometimes I sat on her back while she ate her hay. Not while she ate grain. She was testy then and might lay back her ears. But while she ate hay, she was quiet and peaceful, and I could sit on her. I liked the steady sound she made and the smells of sweet hay and clean horse. I never learned to ride properly. I didn't take many lessons. But I didn't care about this. Most of my riding took place in a wild, romantic dream. I liked riding bareback because that seemed the most authentic. She was one with her horse, I would think. I learned to jump bareback, starting a lifetime of bad riding habits. To this day, I can't seem to put my weight in my stirrups, which means I'm really bad at all the dressage and things like that. Can't do it. I rode badly, but I rode everywhere. We jumped chicken coops and split rail fences. We scrambled up banks and across creeks. We trotted on winding trails through the woods. We cantered through open fields. We galloped at full speed up dirt roads, Babe's ears flattened, her hoofs beating out a hard, clattery tattoo, her long red tail streaming out behind. I fell off a zillion times. I was bucked off, or I slid off over her head when she put it down suddenly, or I was jolted off over a jump. The first time I jumped bareback, I fell off and had to have 4 stitches under my chin right here. The day of my first date, when I was 12, I fell off and broke my pelvis and spent the next 6 weeks flat on my back. In the spring, I rode bareback with a halter and lead shank out into the neighbor's field where the grass was thick and juicy. I sat on her back while she grazed. She took one slow step after another, her head moving in a tugging semicircle as she reached for the new grass. Sometimes I sat backwards on her, brushing her smooth back. Sometimes I lay on her, my arms hanging down on either side. Her beautiful body was my landscape. It was the place I knew best. Its smell, its shape, its textures, the moleskin softness of her muzzle, her loose, muscular lips, the polished summer smoothness of her chestnut flanks, the sweet, grassy scent of her breath, the deep calm of her sigh, the beautiful, liquid darkness of her eyes.
I've read all of these essays many times, but it's amazing to hear the writers read them, which I haven't done until tonight with you. You can hear how much energy there is in these pieces and how much complexity and how much... It's not just love. I mean, it's love, but there's real emotional energy around each of these gifts. I wanted to ask the writers... Whether having done this project, they think differently about presents that they give people. And one of the things that's so interesting about the book for me is that most of the presents are very modest. Roxanne is probably one of the more extravagant presents, but yours was a loan. There's some confusion sometimes. The publisher thought the present was the money, but the present was the loan. It was your mother's ability to create this loan for you. Yes. It wasn't the loan itself.
The loan itself is a metaphor for what she...
Right.
It's the larger thing.
Yeah. And yours were hand-me-downs. So your mother didn't, Margot, she didn't go out and buy you things. She gave you things that were hers. That's what you're writing about.
Yes, exactly. Though, it's a whole lifetime.
Yeah, no, sure.
Buying and whatever.
Of course, but there's...
I know what you mean.
These are presents that are... I mean, a lot of the presents, some of the presents, are, one of them is a used cake pan. One of them is a wok. One of them is a Mexican blouse. This scarf was not an extravagant present. So there are a lot of very modest presents, or more modest. I want to just ask you whether you think differently about giving gifts now, and if you have children or sisters or loved ones, how you might think differently, if you do.
What comes to mind immediately is that we don't know, when we give a gift, we don't know how it's going to endure or last. It's not the pearl earrings that my mother gave me or the necklace or some object. It's something else. And so I do think about that. Mm-hmm. You can't know how it's going to touch the person that you give it to or how it will resonate later on. Mm-hmm. And that I do think about a lot after mm-hmm. having participated in the book.
I suppose I think about what a gift, how it's a palpable expression of someone's character, the person to whom I'm giving it, and how what about it means it could maybe only come from me. So it's an expression of the particular tie between us. I don't always live up to either of these things.
But has doing this project made you think differently?
No, I think I consider those things much more carefully. I think I was often a little more generic before. Well, that's a nice gift. Yes, that will work. Now I try to think of what will remind the person of themselves and of their relationship to me.
Okay, so heightened gift awareness, we can call
there
this. This is a syndrome. It's a new syndrome.
Yes.
Roxana?
I think it just made me focus on the leap of faith that my mother took with this and how great that was in my life. And so, yeah, there's a saying that the more you give, the more you have. The more you give away, the more you have. And it makes you feel great to give a big present. It makes you feel wonderful. It makes you feel powerful and rich and strong. So the bigger the present, especially if it's your own, someone in your own family, your own child, it's kind of wonderful and ennobling to give a big present. So it did make me think in those terms, which is enlarging, life enlarging.
Ennobling is a nice.
Ennobling.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's great. Margot, I was going to ask you, there's a lot of history in your piece, and I was going to ask you about whether you did the history, you did the research for the project, but what you said is that you were in the midst of something, and so in a certain way you were working with the material,
exactly.
The historic material.
This piece spurred me and allowed me to really,
shape it.
Yes, go in particular ways.
Yeah, no,
I'm quite grateful.
And the pieces go from the very, very personal, like mine with the scarf, and the, maybe the cake pan, just for example, to Margot's, which is really a piece of history, a slice of social history about African American women, and through the lens of fashion and fashion magazines. So it's really a very rich culturally and historically a very rich essay. Martha, I wanted to ask you, doing some of these events, people have said that they think of gifts differently from their mothers, having sat in on some of these conversations, and they thought something was a gift, but then they realized something else is a gift. And I'm wondering whether you thought of your mother's, her spirit that allowed this event to happen, whether you thought of that as a gift before I asked you about this, what did you think about that before?
Well, I've always felt incredibly blessed because she, all of her children, she has five daughters, and she encouraged all of us to pursue our dreams, mm-hmm. and
this story encapsulates that. I wanted to be a writer. I was starving in New York, essentially. Not really, but she came up with a way to help me live that dream. But she'd been doing that all along, even ever since I was a little girl. And I recognized that. I guess the essay allowed me to articulate it. But I never lost sight of that. I mean, it was always...
But did you always connect it to the money, to the loan?
Did I always connect...
Well, her...
Well, it's so symbolic of her. She'll do the impossible. She will... You can never say with her, it can't be done. And she gave that to us.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Most definitely. I see it as a metaphor, as I said.
Yeah. Yeah.
Creativity. Yeah, her creativity and her ability to push us. We're all artists. And she never said, marry a rich man or, you know, any of these practical things. So I married a poet.
Roxana, I want to just tell people that for a long time, when I was collecting the essays from the writers, I wondered how I was going to organize the book. And I wondered if I would do it alphabetically or what would happen. And I'm not sure I lost sleep over it, but it was something I wondered about intensely. And then Roxana's essay arrived. And I said, I think that's the opening, because Roxana's mother talks about the ideal mother saying that if possible, a child should have his or her heart's desire, which is, you know, a kind of dream mother, and because Roxana got the dream girl gift of the horse that a lot of us wanted but may not have gotten. And so it seemed like a great way to open this book about presents. But I want to read people... you say that your horse babe, quote, was at the center of that romantic passage in my life when she was my partner in the wild, dangerous ride across adolescence. And I'm wondering whether you always thought that about Babe, whether you thought that in the process of writing the book, writing the essay. I mean, was that sort of how you thought of Babe? Do you want to talk in the...
Sure. Let's see if I can do this without... Okay, I'm not going to touch it. I was always very conscious of the fact... I mean, horses are metaphors, of course, and there is something incredibly powerful, and there's a reason that all girls were horse crazy for a while, and horses give you power, they give you speed, they make you bigger, taller than the guys, they make you faster than the guys. They are super... powers, superheroes. I mean, that's the girl's version of all those superheroes and the whatever, Batman and all those, the guys' toys. And horses do that for girls. And they also, unlike Batman, they put their heads down and they nuzzle you and they want to be loved by you. So it's this incredible superhero world that has opened up to girls. So when I got Babe, it was before I was an adolescent, but I had her during my high school years as well. So she was my secret life. Even though in school I was trying to act like all the girls and learn to wear makeup and learn to dress up like a girl for boys, I still had this secret passionate life. On weekends, I would go home and I would get on my horse and I would gallop cross country bareback. That allowed me a kind of an escape place that didn't relate to the terrifying teenage years of, you know, the horror of being an adolescent and do you look like everyone else and why not, or I don't know which is worse, if you do or you don't, but all that anxiety was absent in the place where I lived with my horse, and my parents gave me that. So I was very conscious of that, but I hadn't written about it. So I was glad to be able to explicitly tease out that relationship between adolescence and the private, powerful bat world of my horse.
So we wanted to ask if anybody had any questions. We'd be happy to... Yes.
Well,
you're Jean's mother?
Yeah.
Oh, hi. I knew you looked familiar. There's a photograph of you on the website. Yes, hi. Hi.
Well, when Jean told me about this book, I thought, what a wonderful idea. And then I got very anxious about what was she going to write about.
Well, thank you very much. This is wonderful. I didn't expect to see any mothers in the audience, but any who maybe were on. I thought maybe Martha's mother might be here. Is she here?
No. She's not.
But thank you so much for speaking. And yes, and you thank you. And you come across very well in the. You're, I just want you to. There's no doubt about that, Jesse.
Were there mothers that have read pieces by?
Who didn't what?
Who didn't welcome what they got?
I haven't heard about any. Do you? Have you heard about any? I know that there was one woman who gave her essay to her mother, and her mother had a few changes she wanted her to make. But it was a very sweet essay. It was not a. And there were, to be sure, there were people who I invited to be in the book who couldn't, who declined because they had difficult relationships with their mothers and they couldn't write about it. So it wasn't like everybody said, oh, great. I mean, there were some people who said, I can't go there right now. So, you know, there might be another volume. Yes, Lorraine.
Hi, Margaret, your mom obviously had standards for how things should be and what should be done the correct way.
Oh,
and I'm wondering, has that carried forth in your life, maybe especially when it's been great, but just in general, as you consider people being, mother wouldn't approve, that wasn't that quite as stylish.
Did everybody hear that? Yeah. The question was, since Margot's mother was so particular about how she should be, and has Margot inherited some of that, and does she see the world through that lens? And
I like to think that I've translated. I think your point about being a critic, a book critic, a theater critic, an arts critic, I think that's no accident, that I was looking for some objective correlative that would also catapult me into, into a world of art, beyond all sorts of conventions and restrictions, which when you're thinking about the arts, you can leap beyond. I would say it's been very complicated. I came of age in the, I went to high school in 1960, I went to college in 64. Huge, tumultuous things happened, and they mattered to me. And a number of those things, the war, civil rights, black power, the women's movement, presented many challenges to the old world of the 50s. My mother is a very intelligent woman, so we have stayed, she's not, strangely, rigidly reactionary. So, we've always conversed, but I like to think my relationship to those exact standards is complex and at least dialectical.
Yes.
Yeah, I find this a very personal conversation, Mother's Day coming up, and what I'm struck with, I read a book many years ago by Hope Edelman called Motherless Daughters. I don't know if you've ever read it. And I consider myself really a motherless daughter, so I find that mother-daughter relationships are really a mystery to me. And my question is, if you had daughters, what gift would you give them?
I have a daughter.
I didn't know if you did or I didn't. I'm just saying if you did, what would you? That's the thing.
Right. Confidence is good.
Do you want to? Could you talk into the mic, please?
You have to give a gift.
That's very.
Oh, it has to be.
An object.
See, I think that goes back to what I was saying earlier. Is that
it's how she's going to take it and what she's going to do with it. You know, so I don't think that's the mystery. It is. I don't think.
I mean, I might pick. I don't have a daughter. I have a great niece and a niece. I might pick. You know, I gave when my niece was about five. I gave her a book that I absolutely adored at that age. It wasn't what she wanted that year for Christmas, so I really rushed out and got her the present she wanted. So, okay. You know, it always ends up metaphorical in some way.
Roxana, do you have, I don't know if you have a daughter.
If you have a daughter, you give her things all the time. You give her objects, you give her your time, you give her your love. Right. So to say what one thing, it would be impossible to choose one thing. You're trying to give her confidence. You're trying to give her
imagination,
a feeling of, which that's something she has or she doesn't, but confidence is something that you have a lot to do with.
I think
but you're always trying.
It's
not one
like your mother did.
Thing.
Yeah.
What I'm getting from all of you, from what you've been saying, is that you're giving a lot of love. I mean, that talking about the metaphor. The metaphor is about sort of unconditional love. I mean, am I wrong?
I don't know.
Could you speak up a little?
I'm just puzzling this because I think that if you are, you know, if things are good, that goes without question.
Right.
The unconditional love is just a natural part of the equation.
Well, it's not always good.
No, I said, oh, yeah, I mean, if things are good.
Yeah.
It's so it's, yes, that's the bottom line. That's the foundation. And then you build up from there, hopefully, with confidence. And
let me take a stab at this and tell you a story. Mary Gordon is one of the contributors to the book, and she was the first person I asked to be in the book because she was the first person I asked to be in the mentor's book, and it worked, so I thought she was my good luck charm. And so I asked her to be in this book, and she wrote back right away, and she said, "Your email has really upset me. My mother never gave me anything but money, and I have nothing to say." And I saw her a few weeks later, and she said, "You know, that email has really stirred up things. I was driving down the West Side Highway in a taxi not long ago, and my husband said, 'Did you ever take the Circle Line boat around Manhattan?' And I remembered," Mary said, "my mother taking the day off from work one day and taking me on the Circle Line." And as you know, if you read Mary's writing, you know, her mother worked every day of her life. And she said, "I want to write about that." And so her essay begins with this bitterness she felt for really all of her life and ends with her reflecting on what it meant to be this little girl with her mother looking out at the city and the sky and the water. And there's a real transformation that happens in the piece. And it's almost like this was a buried memory. And so I think for some of the people, and I think Mary is the perfect example, who really felt aggrieved and felt deprived, the act of remembering this gift, a gift, or thinking of something as a gift that maybe you never thought was a gift, has actually been salutary. And that I was talking on Sunday to a group of seniors, and this woman said at the end, she said, "You know, I came here today and I thought that my mother had never given me anything, not a thing. And as I sat here, I remembered that she came to New York for my wedding, and she'd never done that and she wanted to, and I realized that was a gift." And this is a woman, you know, in her 70s or 80s. So I think this whole gift idea is very elastic. I think that it really changes over time, and I think as we age, it changes, and as we, you know, hear about other people's gifts, it changes, and as we redefine what a gift is, it changes. So I think that there's really a lot of, I don't think it's fixed. And for me, I mean, what I say in my essay is that when I saw books about mothers and daughters, like the really popular big books about mothers and daughters, I didn't even pick them up because I felt like I had no normal relationship with my mother. I didn't know. She was like a very sweet, kind woman, and I felt sorry for her, and I didn't want to be near her. And I felt guilty. And I thought that I had the most, and I thought, oh, mothers and daughters, that's very gooey. That's sort of how I thought about it. It's like, no, I think that's normal, but I didn't know it. And I really felt that way, you know, until the end of her life. And I'm not a kid. So now I'm sort of this conduit for all of these stories about mothers and daughters, and it's so something has changed for me in the process of doing this book. So I think that it's important to sort of see this as a process, and that it doesn't it's not fixed, and it doesn't have to stay that way. Sure. Yes.
I want to continue this line of thinking for a moment, and I think life stage plays a very, very important role in what we see as the most important gift. And having lost my mother, even though my mother gave me confidence and humor and that kind of stuff, what became important to me is something that her hands had touched that I could now touch. So I knew it was something that my mom had held on to. And when I touch it, I think of her hands touching it. And I wonder if there are any writers in the book who talk about something that their grandmother gave to their mother that's tangible, that their grandmother touched, that their mother touched, and now they can hold. And somehow that became something wonderful in the absence of the presence of those people.
Yeah. Nothing comes to mind, but right away. There were a number of people wrote about jewelry that their mother received. A number of people wrote about jewelry that the fathers gave to the mothers and the mothers inherited. I'm not sure that there's exactly that item or that idea in the book. But when I go home, I'll probably think of something. Okay. Yes.
I remember. I was sort of daddy's favorite, and I always felt a little guilty about that. But my mother was very assertive, and I wasn't sure whether she loved me exactly. But a memory came back to me and keeps warming my heart, which was we lived on Riverside Drive. And when it was windy, she walked in front of me. And that tells it all.
Yeah. A gift. Right, that maybe you didn't really ever think of as a gift. That's interesting. Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else? Yes.
How did you select the people that you asked to write pieces?
How did I select the writers? I've been publishing books for many decades and teaching for many decades, so I know a lot of writers. And so I started thinking about excellent writers. I started thinking about people who write essays. So I wanted, in this book, there are poets, fiction writers, and journalists. And so I was looking for really, you know, top people, and people who wrote personal essays or had written them, and people who were approachable enough for me to approach them. If somebody has absolutely no way for you to get in touch with them, it's hard to get in touch with them. No names. No, I mean, but that's just how it is, and I know enough about this that, you know, you have to. It's hard to reach some people. They don't want to be reached. And there was some. So I wanted a lot, as much variety as I could get, in terms of ages, backgrounds, experiences. One of the mothers in the book is a Holocaust survivor who's a quadriplegic. One of the mothers in the book is Letty Pogrebin, who started Ms. Magazine. So there's a huge variety of women. One of them is a woman who owned a delicatessen in Queens, who was an immigrant. And so there's a lot of variety in the book, even. So it's a lot of it's sort of like looking for houses, I mean, or looking for gifts. I mean, you sort of go and look and ask and sort of pick up people's work and see if they're interested. So it takes a while. Yes.
Because I wanted to know, you have 31 writers in the book.
Why 31? Well, I'm the 31st, and. it just sort of came out that way. It could have been 29. It's not a magic number, but there might have been 32. So it's just a matter of who decides, who answers you, who comes through, who wants to do it. So it's very imprecise as far as the number. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to see if there's anybody who hasn't. Yes, go ahead.
I just wanted to say it's about the horses, but I appreciate that insight because I have a granddaughter who loves horses, and I didn't quite understand it. And now I understand.
Magic country.
Is there another question? Okay, well, thank you all very much. This has been a great event. Thank you to the library. Really great. Thanks.
So I'd just like to remind everyone that there are books for sale in the lobby. Our friends from the Corner Bookstore are there. And there's a computer at the back. If you'd like to look at their blog page for the book, it's whatmymothergaveme.tumblr.com. And I'm sure if you just do a Google search on it, you'll find their blog page as well.
And Roxanne has something. If you go to my website, elizabethbenedict.com, it says... Click into Tumblr. No, it does it? I don't know. Put that on there. But you can see the pictures of the gifts. And Roxanne has this amazing picture of the horse.
Liz asked me to bring this. So this is me jumping on my horse.
Oh my you can come up and see it.
Yeah.
It's not in the Tumblr, but there's all the stuff on the website.
So thank you all for coming.
Oh, that is fantastic. This is